This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. As you probably know, we build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland. Now, we're into a new year now, 2022, but we're still living in the northeast of Scotland with the aftermath of Storm Arwen, so quite a few of the items in this week's podcast refer back to that. Hello, a very good morning and a happy new year to you. Find me discomforted, friends. I'm sitting here in the car park discomforted, watching the sparks fly away into the night. Because round the corner, I'm not sure what it is, I think it's something to do with Aberdeen Hospital, Aberdeen Royal Infirmary. They're building something, but they've covered it in red lights and I haven't noticed it before. So I went round the corner and went, whoa! It's like opening your bedroom curtains and suddenly finding yourself in an edition of Blade Runner. I've no idea what's going on. Anyway, 40 miles to the north in the Aberdeenshire countryside near Banff, equally perplexed, Mr. Ewan McElriff.
The scene end of this partnership. Beautiful frosty morning, gentle snow coming down, and sleepless nights, because bracken over the festive period produced 9 huge puppies and is now demanding fed every couple of hours and comfort breaks throughout the night. Good morning. You can email us out of doors, if you can do better than that, and Mark can because he's got kittens, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number is 80295, standard network message rate applies, and give Owen a call. 08085 92 95 00. You've got that image of people leaping out of bed all over the country and writing that important number down. And while you're doing that, the mystery bird is back.
Can I just say I haven't a clue? Not a clue.
Well, it sounds like an easy one, but it's not.
It's not.
They are round our coast at the moment. They are a winter visitor, that's all we're going to say at the moment. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295, standard network message rate applies, and call Owen. Now, we were really, really, really busy before Christmas. 08085 92 95 00.
Heaps more coming up in the programme this week. We're going to be talking about Gaelic place names, how rich, you know, how descriptive they are. Historian Dan Snow will be joining us to talk about a fascinating expedition that's going on in the Antarctic. More on that soon. But first, the aftermath of Storm Arwen, which was just devastating for this part of the world, is still very, very clear to see.
Yeah, tell me about it. Most of my trees are gone.
Millions of trees were uprooted, and forests are still inaccessible as a result. I was very curious to find out what this meant for commercial foresters, so I went to meet Will Anderson. Will's a chartered forester and chief executive of Seafield and Strathspey Estates, and we met up at one of their plantations near Port Soy. I asked him, just cast his mind back to that particularly fateful Friday.
If you want to have sleepless nights as a forester, you watch the weather forecast and you look for north or easterly gales. And that's when you start to get a bit nervous, when you hear it howling around the house from a north or an easterly direction, because you can expect there'll be some damage somewhere the following day.
How bad was it getting up on the Saturday morning?
It was interesting, shall we say, because we spent the majority of the Saturday and most of the Sunday basically clearing roads and trying to open areas up. And I mean, we're still clearing access tracks even yet. We just prioritise things, and even between Christmas and New Year we had machines running round about certain areas clearing off roads, and we still have more to do yet. It was certainly the worst experience I've had as far as damage is concerned in my career to date.
Numerous places round about the northeast I've seen coniferous plantation like this particularly, and I don't know why, and it all seems to be same age, And some of it's been absolutely flattened. Just everything's gone. Some of it, it's almost as if, you know, somebody's driven a truck or something right through the middle of it. How does that happen?
It's a gust. It's a wind gust that does that. You can get damage to the edge of a plantation, and in a lot of cases, the plantation has a boundary. So you sometimes see the example where the centre of the plantation is flat, but all the trees around the outside are standing. That's because the trees around the outside are more wind firm because they're naturally exposed to it, they're used to it. In situations like this, this is a very good, very stable site under normal circumstances. I would not expect this to get serious wind blow unless you get winds of the intensity that we had in Storm Arwen. What you're finding in here, and you'll see it further along here as well, is there is a line driven through the wood, and that is simply a gust, and it gets going. And sometimes you can do it just as simply with the strength of wind. Sometimes what happens is you get several gusts, and the trees start to get into rhythm, and they're in the wrong part of that bending moment, if you like, when the next gust comes and it just takes a whole lot over.
Yeah. Almost like a destructive frequency.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's exactly that, destructive frequency. Because these are, you know, they're natural living entities and they react in certain ways. And if you just get them at the wrong time, you know, and this was a wind from the wrong direction. If it was coming from that direction, we probably wouldn't have seen as much damage in the west. Because it was coming from the north, this is not a direction the trees are normally braced against, and that made it even worse. What we're looking at here, for example, is a plantation of Scots pine. It was planted in 1950, so it's about just over 70 years old. We know roughly what the standing volume of that is. So when we look at this, say, from an aerial photograph, we can assess the extent of the damage, we can look at that, and we can quantify what has actually been damaged as opposed to what is still standing. And it's that, that really that we're now looking at to give us an idea going forward. Our initial estimates immediately after the storm on the estate here were that we had around about 30,000 tonnes damaged. I think I'll up that slightly now to perhaps maybe 35, nearer 40,000 tonnes now that I've had a chance to go around and look at some of the damage. But essentially for us, that is about 2 years worth of felling. So we normally produce around about 15,000 tonnes per annum anyway from the estate. So we're looking at damage equivalent to 2 years of our sustainable yield.
The fact that the trees are over, you might think, well, that's fine, it's not a good problem, you can come back and get them any time. Is there a time limit on this? Are you up against the clock in any way?
Yes, we are, and it's predominantly in the pine crops. Generally speaking, with pine, there are two issues with it. One is that once it goes over like this, we've got a time frame where we have to recover it because it starts to stain. There's a fungus goes into it called blue stain, and that will affect the salability of the wood at the end of the day. We're probably in the best time of year for it just now because it'll take a little bit of time. It's warmer weather, obviously, when that sort of stain happens, and so we have time to plan. But we need to do that in conjunction not only with Scottish Forestry, who give us the licences to do this, but also with the market, with the sawmillers, who have to place the timber that we then produce onto the market into their customers at the end of the day.
Everybody must be under pressure at the moment because getting skilled workers, getting the machines, getting somewhere to put it at the end of the day must be a real serious issue at the moment.
Yes, it is. And what we're seeing probably is some people diverting, which what we will do is we'll divert from planned felling coops to try and tidy up some of this to give priority to the stuff which is damaged through the storm. And the sort of double whammy you have with that is that this takes a lot longer to clear up. So as well as bringing machines in here, it's not as productive for the machines. So obviously our cost goes up, but also the time taken to clear it means that it's reducing the available volume elsewhere in the estate because people are spending longer clearing this up than they would do if they were in a standing crop with no damage in it.
Two trees in front of us here. One of them just blown complete with the roots. The other one across there is actually snapped halfway down. Does that affect the value?
Yeah, very much so. We lose both volume and value. We can lose probably up to 30% of the volume and probably 35% of the value because some of the snap you see there is in the most productive part of the tree. So it's the stuff which is going for the higher value element, the sawlog element. We've waited 70 years for this, and suddenly we've lost the most valuable part of some of these trees because the stem is snapped. The difficulty is trying to fell this in a sensible way to allow us to then replant it once we've actually felled the timber that's on here, because we've got to look at the forward from this. We're not just looking at clearing this up. We're looking at saying, well, where do we need to take this to a sensible size to make the replanting of this suitable for future management? We're also looking at it from the point of view of what can we recover? We don't want to flood the market with pine timber. There's a lot of pine timber damaged in the northeast.
Because the price goes down.
Well, yes, it does. But there's various different aspects in that. But the fact is that we want to try and minimise the amount of pine we put on the market at the moment, because we know there's a lot of it about. And there is a limit to what the sawmillers can actually place to their customers as well. So we have to take that into recognition and try to say, for a site like this, and it will cost us, because we'll come in and we'll take out the damaged area, but we may look in a year, 2 years, 3 years' time to fell more than that to make a sensible-sized coupe at the end of the day for replanting.
The reason I wanted to speak to you particularly is I saw something in social media saying that because of the scale of the problem, this has become a real cooperative effort with all the concerned parties.
Yes, it is. And we've had meetings with all the main players in this, both from the agency side, from Scottish Forestry, from the sawmilling side, from ourselves as a private state. So we're all pulling together in the same direction, because we all recognise that everything is interconnected in this. We all stand to gain or lose out of it if we don't do this the right way. So the best thing to do is put our heads together and make sure we've got a good direction of travel. And that's what's been happening. There's another meeting coming up on, I think, the 27th of January as a follow-up, when we should hopefully have a better handle on information, both from Scottish Forestry's satellite imagery, but also feeding in from the members of the group to get an idea of exactly what final quantity of timber we're actually looking at in this area and what that has impacted. Certainly for us, I mentioned that 30,000 tonnes, about a third of that from our point of view is pine. So we're looking at that and feeding that into that to then give the sawmillers an idea of what it is they're going to have to try and look for markets for at the end of the day.
Will Anderson of Seafield and Strathspey Estates, I found that fascinating.
I thought he explained it fantastically, simply and elegantly. That fact that trees aren't used to a northerly wind, they're not ready for it, is just really informative.
Very insightful. We'll hear more from Will later in the programme, because obviously they're dealing with the current situation, but they're also planning for the future. Now, our producer Phil Syme, our occasional producer Phil Syme, sadly his guide dog Guinness passed away last March, and since then, because Phil is blind, he's pretty much had to rely on sighted assistance every time he wanted to leave the house. But this year, he's very focused on getting his independence back, which will enable them to enjoy the outdoors again. Phil recently met up with Sight Action's mobility officer Raymond Smart in Inverness for a lesson in how to use a white cane.
So, practicalities, Raymond. We've got the cane here. We've got a big long street with lots of obstacles and all the rest of it. How do we use it?
Okay, you sweep from left to right, or right to left. You know, you just sweep it across the width of your own shoulders, really, because if you go outside that, the travel is increased quite a lot, and therefore it's not keeping pace. So as you step, the cane moves in time with your steps.
So are you almost like trying to create an arc movement then?
Yes, from one side to the other. And that arc is, in this instance, because you're tall, it's about 3 or 4 feet in front of you. So that gives you 3 or 4 feet of warning for an obstacle.
If you're only sweeping that the width of your shoulders, obviously, you know, the width of shoulders will vary depending on the individual, but how do you keep on a straight line? Or how do you know you're going in a straight line? Because I have no visual reference at all.
This is the most difficult problem for those with absolutely no vision. You've got to remember that 97% of us who are registered blind have some residual vision. However, with no residual vision, there is no reference. You can't follow a fence line. You can't see the difference between the pavement and the grass, the colour difference. You can't see textures. So therefore, you're using your ears and the reflected sound from the cane.
I suppose the other thing that I'm thinking about is, having had guide dogs for so many years, I've been completely unaware of obstacles on the street, whether that be street furniture, whether it be cars on the pavement, because the dog will automatically find a way around it. So I, as a visually impaired person or somebody with no sight, I'm unaware of these obstacles. But with this cane, you become aware of everything in your steps.
It's a big shock to the system, because you just feel that the dog's weaving in and out of something. You're not aware of what. However, with a cane, you hear the differences. So you know you've hit a bin, a wheelie bin, a lamppost. Everything has its own sound. And on this corner, I'm just about to demonstrate that.
Okay.
So if you listen quietly to the cane.
Pole.
Exactly.
Hold on a minute. You've just hit that pole, or yep. What sounded like a pole.
It was.
I would have no idea if that was a bollard. Do you run the cane up it to see how tall it is, or do we need to know what that actually is, or do we just need to know that's an obstacle there?
Now, we do need to know that it's there, because that's our reference point to the end of this person's street, okay? So if you lived in that street, you're obviously going to look for that pole, that street sign.
For the next time you want to go there?
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Now, however, we've got a couple of other references here that might help us with that for this particular street.
You're going over the sound of a drain.
I've gone over the sound of BT's box in the ground, not a drain.
Got it.
The drain's got a metal sound.
And that's more plasticky.
I'm going to verify that sound because BT's box.
I'm laughing because it's really interesting, because when I step out with the dog, I literally just go from A to B, right? The dog's intelligence and the dog's memory of a well-known route will take me to my end point. What we're looking for here, we're actually going seeking obstacles to try and identify where we are in particular parts of a street.
We are doing what the dog's eyes do. We are finding the way. So, that's a lamppost. And it's tall. Listen, wait till this car goes.
What kind of sound do the cars make when you hit them?
Bang. Some of them swear at you. Or perhaps that's the driver.
Okay.
Are you blind? Did you not see me coming?
Okay, so this is a pole we've got here.
Yeah, so listen.
So it's got a kind of a reverb tinny effect on it.
Definitely. Okay.
That's incredible how your ears tune into the sound of various obstacles or objects on the pavement, whether that be a drain cover, you know, a BT box cover, a lamppost, or just a pole.
We're building an audio picture of our world around that particular street that we used there.
You know, I'm somebody who loves to kind of get outdoors, whether that's, you know, a walk along a forest track or a walk to the local park or down by the River Ness. I've got some fabulous walks down there. Does the cane have limitations in terms of the terrain it can take you?
You'll have no doubt heard the saying that the snow is a blind man's fog. Because we can't see anything, because we can't hear anything in the snow. The cane doesn't make a sound. All the time, all through this little journey here, the cane's been making a sound that I've been listening to and you've been listening to.
Yes.
As soon as we walk off, and I'll just demonstrate, we're on the pavement now. Now we're on the grass. There's practically nothing.
There's no feedback.
Nothing.
No audio feedback.
No auditory feedback.
You get the feedback through the feeling of the cane, but yes. You don't know what that is.
You just know that the cane is dragging. It's being dragged by the blades of grass.
So final question, Raymond, for somebody like yourself who has owned a guide dog, you've also worked a cane for many, many years as well. How does the cane shape up against the guide dog?
That's a million-dollar question. They both get you there. They both get you there. And they both have their advantages. The dog has the advantage that you're more relaxed. The cane has the advantage that when you put it, fold it up and put it behind the door, that's you finished with it. But then you can't play with the cane, can you?
You can't throw a ball either.
No, you cannot. Well, you can try, but I'll not do anything.
It's another fascinating insight. Raven Smart there from Sight Mobility, along with producer Phil Syme.
And such a fascinating things you say. and a perfect piece of radio.
Yeah, yeah, you know, precisely.
Lets you, you know, you can never really imagine it, but it kind of gives you a glimpse into Phil's world. Fascinating stuff.
Just yet another story. Coming up, an Antarctic expedition to find Shackleton's lost ship. And something that was bugging me, how do birds cope with extreme weather events?
Well, yeah, I mean, it must be a real shock if you think, it was the same 35% of the forest in that particular forest gone. Mm-hmm. And not just that, I mean, it must have... Imagine how terrifying it would be, a roosting bird in the middle of that. I lost a pile of trees, and, you know, so there's a considerable amount of habitat must have disappeared.
Bang smack in the middle of Storm Arwen, I was out in the back garden with a head torch, you know, because we were trying to sort of batten down a roof. And I swung it round. I thought, what is that up in the Scots Pine or whatever? And it was a wood pigeon hanging on for grim life. I mean, just, you know, literally by its toenails, more or less. Must have been really scary for them, too.
Yeah, you wonder how many wood pigeons woke up in Cornwall.
Quite.
Yeah, I mean, talking of birds, and this is really disappointing. People are getting this right already, but have a listen to this. I wouldn't have gotten that, but some people are. Get in touch if you think you know what it is. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number is 80295 and a standard network message rate applies. And you can call us. Owen's taking your calls. 08 085 92 95 00. I would not have got this one.
No, neither would I. Simon up in Orkney has nearly got it right. He says, is the bird a great skewer? Bonksy. If not, it's an Arctic skewer. Scooty Allen. Neither, I'm afraid, Simon. We do have two correct answers so far, which is slightly astonishing. This is in from Susan and Derek in Edinburgh. Nothing to do with the mystery bird. Says, good morning and happy 2022. Our Hogmanay evening kicked off with G&T's and listening in again to Ewan's interview with his dad, his description of Hogmanay's past and singing for its Hogmanay, Hogmanay. An outstanding piece of broadcasting and so touching. We will save it for future years. Thank you very much, Susan and Derek in Edinburgh.
Well, it had me greeting anyway.
I don't blame you at all. Last year, the Ascent Foundation was awarded funding by Nature Scots' Peatland Action Programme to undertake restoration of degraded peat on the lower slopes of Coolmore near Ullapool. Just before Christmas, producer Dan Holland met ecologist Chris York from environmental consultancy firm Walking the Talk on the site and asked him, first of all, just to describe Coolmore.
It's a very open moorland area. It's quite windswept. The clouds are scudding across the hillsides. I came up past Benmore Cuigach this morning and the cloud was just shrouded over the edge there. And it's just an open moorland with sort of boggy pools everywhere. It's pretty wet. On the slopes of Coolmore, what we found is that some of the surface of the peat has become exposed through sort of long-term degradation, if you like. It's a pretty harsh environment, so it doesn't take very much for that thin skin of vegetation to get broken, possibly through things like grazing pressure, and it will be things like the change of the climate. The vegetation is less resilient than it was in the current climate conditions. So what we've ended up with are bare areas of peat. The vegetation has been eroded away, and then that allows water to erode into the peat, and that's it then washed away. It's kind of like death by a thousand cuts, really. You end up with lots and lots of small wounds, if you like, and the peat bleeds away. So what we're trying to do here is to repair those wounds. The idea really is to patch up those bare areas and allow the vegetation to regrow.
And how do you measure that, the quality of the peat, or how do you identify those areas that are being eroded away?
So what we did, we started in 2018, we did a feasibility study, a team of us, and we looked at aerial images, aerial photography, and identified the areas where there was peat. And those images, you can actually see the bare peat, and you can measure the extent of that bare peat. So you work out where's the most damaged spot and then focus in, and that involves going out and tromping over the peatlands. So what we did was we took a grid. Every 100 metres, we got a long stick and poked it into the ground to see how deep the peat was. essentially measured the condition of the peat. We've got a scale from very good to very, very poor. What we looked at was where was the most damage and which areas would benefit the most from some restoration work.
I think we've all become, over the last few months, years, we've all become so much more aware about our carbon footprints, about the climate emergency. Spell out for us, Chris, what is the significance of degraded peat? What is the problem of degraded peat? Because it's an incredible carbon capture store, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the storage of carbon in peatlands in Scotland, I think it's something like 140 years worth of our emissions. If you let it all out, that would be the equivalent. So it's storing a huge amount of carbon. And obviously, as it erodes, that carbon is emitted. So we're contributing even more. We're not actively making that emission. So it's not like by us driving a car. This is we'll call it a natural process, but we've induced that by the way that we're managing the land. So those erosion areas, that peat is being washed out and the carbon that's in there is then being emitted. In terms of carbon, I think it's about a bucket and a half of peat has a kilogram of carbon in it. So that gives you an idea of what we're talking about. This project is going to protect about 1.3 square kilometres of peatland. Within that, I think we're doing something like 11 kilometres of peat hags to restore. When you work that out, the amount of peat that we would lose every year is something like 4,500 bags of compost, the equivalent of. So if you go to the garden centre, you'll see a big 50-litre compost bag. 4,500 of those are being washed off just this area every year. And that's what we're trying to stop.
To the untrained eye, to bring machinery, to bring plant up onto the moorland, visibly, that will create damage. So how are you actually doing the restoration? What does the work involve?
First of all, it's been done by specialists, highly trained machine operators, and they've got specialist machines. So they've got very, very wide tracks. So they're what's called low ground pressure machines. So they can almost float over the ground. They don't do a huge amount of damage as they're tracking through. But then what we do, it's essentially a bit of surgery, really, almost like a skin graft. If we've got all of these cuts that are in the surface, what we're doing is repairing those by grafting existing vegetation back across and covering up the bare peat. So it's using the big bucket on the excavator to move around vegetation. We're not bringing anything in, so we're just moving stuff around and reducing the steep slopes on those peat hags are the things that are eroding. So what the contractor is going to do is to reduce that slope and put vegetation over the top of it, and that will then start to grow back and prevent the erosion of the peat from underneath.
And so to keep your sort of surgical healthcare and metaphor going, what's the recuperation period? What's the fallow period before you know that this work is having a beneficial effect, that that vegetation has taken hold?
The rate of growth is very, very slow. You're looking at 5 or 10 years before you can genuinely think that you've made the impact or that you can see the impact. And during that period, obviously, it needs a rest. So we have to think about how we manage the land during that period and going forward. What's happened didn't happen over the course of 2 or 3 years. It happened over decades, possibly centuries. This is a very long-term problem that we're having to deal with. And, you know, we have to do it now before it's too late.
Ecologist Chris York from Walking the Talk speaking to producer Dan Holland there. It is a remarkably fragile environment.
It's another fascinating interview as well. But, you know, a bucket of peat contains a kilogram of CO2. That's just fascinating stuff. But it's just great to get folk that are really on the game, you know, they know what they're talking about, and that ability to explain it really simply is fascinating. And you think about how many millions of tons of peat have been burnt and dug up in the, over the years.
Yeah.
It's surprising we've got anything left at all.
I can't, it must be about 10, 12 years ago, I was wandering up around Coolmore with a ranger. And, you know, in the space of one day, we were watching golden eagles, you know, and I made some comment about stags because it was the rutting season. And literally as we came around the corner, there was a magnificent stag just dripping in mud. You know, looked superb. Been a real memory, that, for me. Coming up, more on how the Scottish forestry industry is dealing with the aftermath of Storm Arwen, and how wildlife cope too.
Yeah, we've got a mystery bird again. I know you will be so delighted. Sadly, quite a few people have got it right, but luckily Peter Niven and Isla Butte thought it was a great skua or a bonksy. No, it's not. Have a listen to this. And it's not the one that's in the background, which you can hear. It's a visitor from the north, and it arrives here in winter. They're all round their coast at the moment. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, standard network message rate applies, and you can call us 08 0852 9500. Owen's taking the calls, and you know, there's no prizes. It's just the honour of getting it right, or even the honour of getting it wrong.
The even greater honour of getting it wrong, yeah, precisely. Yeah. If you go up to the Murray Firth coast, there's an Art Deco gem there, sadly decayed. At its heyday, Tarlea Outdoor Pool near Macduff attracted literally thousands of people from far and wide.
Yeah, sadly, as you say, it's seen better days, and there have been years of campaigning to bring it back to its former glory. The good news is that part of the site has recently been awarded £1.4 million of funding to allow restoration. Now, John Cox is a local councillor and a tourism specialist, and he's got a special relationship with this pool and its history.
We're standing here in Tarlea, and if we were to start a journey in terms of tourism and attractions and an environment, this is where we would start. It is absolutely an amazing location.
Because I've talked about this before, but we'll just go, it's a bit blustery today, but it is the perfect natural amphitheatre. I mean, it could make a good marina, but I think a swimming pool is perfect.
Just the setting, just coming along here, sitting, and even today you could see, looking out to sea, looking all around the building, just it ticks all the boxes.
Do you remember swimming here?
I remember coming down here about 50-odd years ago. There were boats, swimming, there was the diving, and the place was packed. Yes, I do remember. I still have that in my memory.
You see the pictures, and there are thousands of folk here.
Yeah, it was what it was in its day. This is what people holidayed locally. You used to get loads of people coming off the train, arriving from Glasgow, the south, and this was the location they came to. And even today, people talk about when their parents, grandparents used to come to this area. So, yeah, back in those days, it was a phenomenal place to be.
It's a bit sad looking at the moment. I mean, to my mind, the actual pool, because you've got the paddling pool with a wee artificial island, you've got the other pool and you've got the diving pool. It looks savable.
It's everything is here. Yeah, absolutely. A lick of paint can make a huge difference to anything. And that's, you know, we're looking at standing here at the pavilion, and they have the plans to turn it into a cafe. The council has spent money, and the late John Anderson, architect, he came along and he had the vision as well for the place. So a lot of tribute to the work that he put into it.
Yeah, we'll go on about the Art Deco pavilion in a second, but the history of this place was... You know, they had the idea, I think, in 1929, and they got the local clerk of works to get on with it, and it was up and running in 2 years. Unheard of now.
Well, it would probably take a lot longer than that in terms of planning applications and all these things, but that's a system. Back in those days, someone came up with a good idea, they just got on with it.
Now, we're just going to turn... Well, let's go down here a wee bit, because it is a wonderful, I said Art Deco pavilion, very, very square... And real 1930s classic architecture.
Those were the designs in those days, and it's still fitting today. It still has that character that you wouldn't say, well, we need to change it. No, we need to protect this, save it, get it back into use. Yeah, it's fantastic.
And it's very much, I would argue, come back into its day, because it was designed to embrace the outdoors, embrace the sunshine, just get a healthier lifestyle. And that's very much in mode today.
if there's anything to come out of the COVID thing, I think people now recognise what they are, appreciate what they have in their actual doorstep. And in a lovely day, just after, and I think it was the first, went out for a walk, and there was hundreds of people out and about, and that's not an exaggeration. We have it here, and I think it has woken people up to look at your own doorstep before. You don't need to jump on a plane, you don't need to travel very far. There is so much to enjoy here.
And it's got £1.4 million from the Scottish Government. The Council, Aberdeenshire Council, have been right behind the project from the start. And that money presumably can bring this place back to life.
We can bring it back into a place. I mean, it can be used today. There is nothing stopping people coming down here and just enjoying the environment. We've got to pay tribute to the Friends of Tarnlea Group who've got that vision. So anything that can be done, as I say, from the money that's coming forward and other match funding, we've got the perfect product here for tourism.
Yeah, I was down here last year. I thought, yeah, I'm not hoping hell in getting money for this. You know, we're stuck up in the northeast of Scotland. Who cares about us?
Well, yes and no, but it's determination, and it's coming up with the idea and that vision, and that quite clearly has gone right through the process, and people have picked that up and say, yes, this is a very much worthwhile project to invest in.
Because we nearly lost it. Aberdeenshire Council wanted to fill this in with concrete.
Well, the council has its pressures, so there was a period where this was neglected, but it took the group of the Friends to come up with that vision, as I said, and you know, the result is there that this money's coming through, and hopefully all the match funding will fall into place as well.
Sorry, I'm being slightly negative about the council there, but actually, they saved it. There's only a handful in the country. This was saved, and I mean, am I being naive? Has this got the potential to bring in tourists?
Absolutely. It's the environment we have here. It's ticking all the boxes. You can walk from here along to the fantastic harbour and White Hills, continue along the coast. We've got so many different things from Finlitter Castle. We have it here. It isn't just about one place. It's going to put Macduff back on the map. The Banffshire Coast. The Banffshire Coast, we established that many years ago. It is a brand, and this is part of that. So from this, from the looking out to the sea, the boat trips, the bird sanctuary along the coast, we have it here. And I think this will play a huge part in that.
I'm naively excited about this. You know, folk coming back in their thousands. Jethro Tull played here. Wet, wet, wet played here.
People still talk about when Wet, Wet, Wet turned up in their helicopter. And there were thousands of
you
people.
You were there.
I was here. I stood up at the top there. You couldn't have wished for a better day. The dolphins out in the bay, they even enjoy the music.
Wet, 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 ending that interview with Councillor John Cox. A terrible recording of the music.
Appalling, but as far as I'm aware, there wasn't a commercial recording of that. But such, you can imagine, and we've talked about it quite a few times, but it's such a wonderful location, and they had a fantastic day for it. Yeah. And thousands of people just sitting on the grass listening to Wet, Wet, Wet. Brilliant.
Yeah, spot on, spot on. This has come in from Felicity saying, just been listening to your New Year's Day episode, which I thought was superb, a masterful weaving of place, interviews and stories. I missed it when it was broadcast, not because of a hangover, because I was writing. Early morning is when my head is clearest. It was lovely to hear you and Mark's reaction to Moniak Moor, which reminded me of my two visits there. I was definitely in Mark's camp in terms of my reaction, being distracted by the wonderful location and views. Like Kit Fraser, I need solitude to write, but found the courses stimulated me to develop my writing in new directions. Now, Moniak Moor is Scotland's creative writing centre. If you missed that episode, you can still catch up on BBC Sounds. While we were there, we spoke to Dr. Heather Klein, who's a lecturer in Gaelic, about the origins of place names and their importance. First of all, I asked about the place name of the place we were actually standing.
It's a great subject for people who like to study place names,
mm-hmm.
because the word Moniak Moor is actually was a name that was kind of put on the place here. So the bit that we're standing on at the moment, its older name when you look on the maps is actually Tyavadan, which is possibly the Baron's house, but it might actually mean something else. There's a bit of debate about that as well. But it was Kit and his sister who chose to put the name Moniak on the site when they started the writing centre, to just keep the connection between the Frasers and the site here. And I think just to differentiate it from Moniak or Moniak Castle, they added more after it, but for some reason that's got a bit lost in the history of the centre, everybody pronounces it Moore,
even rather though it's written
Vore. Rather than Vore. And I think it's partly a little bit of a lack of understanding, and partly just once people start to say something one way, that's the way it ends.
Everybody does it that
Everybody does it that way. But the name itself, Moniac, actually, it comes from a pure Gaelic word. And so it's Monag. Monag is the first part of it, and Iach is the second part. So it's Moniac, which means the moor or the plain. Of it's a type of grain, beer meal, an older type of grain.
90-day barley.
Is that what it's called? Okay.
90-day, yeah.
Okay, so I know that they still grow it in Orkney, so it's the old hardy...
And Shetland.
Old hardy grain that they used to grow here. So when you look at it down on the plain by Moniac Castle, it makes absolute sense because it's the big plain and where they would have where they were growing that kind of grain at the time. But when you bring it up here, actually what it means is the Creative Writing Centre.
Having you as a Gaelic-speaking resource... for creative writers, because it's an extra thing to tap into, because you can tell them what these place names mean.
I can, if they want to know.
Well, do you not just tell them?
So, well, sometimes they do, but actually one of the things that I think is quite nice about the centre is that people come and they work with this fantastic view that we can see out in front of us, and for them, I think it's a bare canvas for them, and they can put whatever they want to on the landscape as part of the writing. And so I think for them, for the writers who are coming here to write about another place or another time or another environment, it's a perfect place for them to be because they don't understand where they are. But it's different if they decide that they want to write about the Highlands or they want to place their characters in the Highlands. Then I think it becomes really important that they get a bit of an assistance to make sure that they get it right so that it's not just... there's not too much Mickey-upathy or something that makes...
That's a lovely phrase. Not Mickey-upathy again.
Not Mickey-upathy or something that makes all the Gaelic speakers, because there are a lot of us, really cringe when you read something. And if you read something that's really poorly put together in Gaelic, the whole piece of writing loses credibility. You can't deal with it after that.
Again, it's also a means of reading landscapes. It's a very, very descriptive language, Gaelic. I mean, I'm just touching my toe in it at the moment, but it's you immediately start to see things around you and you think, oh, wait a minute. You know, Greenock, sunny, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
Seriously?
Absolutely. Well, for me...
As anybody who's ever been to Greenock will know, the girls got said to you.
Well, for me, the only way I can describe it is it's a little bit like synesthesia. You know, when...
Yes,
so, and for me, personally, that's what I feel like. So there's nothing that I love better than... Well, being at home, first of all, with a map, opening it, and then looking at the place, I'm trying to work out what it means, and then actually going to the place itself and checking out to see whether it does mean that. Because quite often, you know, there's different interpretations about a place name depending on who wrote it down or how it's spelt or how it's recorded. And sometimes there's a bit of Mickey-upathy in that as well.
Yeah.
But sometimes when you go to a place, you can see, yes, it is actually the big burn with the sharp cliff beside the tongue of land, and the place name makes complete sense.
We're standing on this hill and the sun is just skirting the horizon over Loch Ness at the moment, but we can still pick out the landscapes. Can you name some of these places for us and just explain what it means?
It's a really difficult thing when people say something to me like, can you pick out some place names? Because really I could just start over here and work my way around for the full 360 and get excited about every single place. But, I mean, for example, if we look down there into the sun, and it's actually a really cold day here at the moment, and there's a hill... It's like the biggest part of the landscape that you see it from everywhere, and it's Miel Fuirbhonnie, and people know it. They know it's a really well-trodden path up, and it appears on the Walk Scotland website, and it means that kind of lumpy hill out on the cold moor. And today, I'm sure it is really cold up there. But when you're on the hill itself and you look down, you see the moor, and it does make it makes complete sense. But from down here, it's all you see is the hill, really.
Well, what about the Field of the People? Where is it?
So the Field of the People, that's an interesting one, and it's one of my favourite local place names, because when I was a child, one of the names that we would give to tourists to catch them out was a place just opposite Fort William, and it's called Achafupol. And it would be, you know, when people were looking for directions, you'd always say to them, well, take the road down by Achafupol and watch them go kind of a little bit white. So the name Achafupol is actually almost the same word as Achpopoli, which is up the road from us just here. It's just into the setting sun as well. And when you look at the word without a good knowledge of it, it looks like the Field of the People. So it sets up this whole kind of local story about that actually it was a place where people would gather. And then people decided that the reason that people would gather must be for having a market. So then the story grew that people would use that large area upland for people from Inverness would come out and sell things up there. And then actually when you really look at it, it actually means the Field of the Canopies, which is then people would... use that again as a reason to believe that it was a place where there was a market. But when you look at it logically, it doesn't make any sense. It's a fairly inaccessible upland site. So the word Achpopoli actually means the field of the, and it's canopies or temporary canvas covers. It's the old shealings. So it's the field, it's the field of the shealings. And then as soon as you look into the word, look into the meaning of the word, within one word you get the whole understanding about transhumance, about people using the uplands in the summer, and there would be temporary shelters that they would take down. So just from getting one word right, you get this whole plethora of stories and history and people that, it just floats my own personal boat. One of the things that's interesting for me is, of course, when the names were all recorded and written down, they were recorded by a certain sector of the population. They weren't always recorded by the right people who had the information, and sometimes they were recorded just in not entirely the right fashion. But what happened then at that point was that suddenly that song line, if you like, became static. And from then on in, place names don't change, because once you have it written on a map, what's Huey's Field is going to be Huey's Field, whether it's Huey, Jock or Seamus that own the field. It's always going to be Huey's Field. So in a way, the story stops there. And it's only when you get people coming and putting new place names on new places that the story takes up again. And sometimes those things are a bit hard to pick apart. I have a cousin who lives just up the road. And if you look on the Ordnance Survey map, his house name's there. And it says Furry Boots.
And if you, is he Aberdonian by any chance?
His girlfriend at the time, his wife now, is Aberdonian. but if you come into this place here in the house that's got no relation really with the language of Aberdeen, and look on the Ordnance Survey map and try and work out what that means, well, good luck to you.
For those not acquainted with the Doric language, faraboot is it means where is it?
That's it entirely. So I love that. So that is a place name that I actually really
one
like.
One that grabbed me, and I don't know where it is, but hopefully we can see it. The Big Pit of the Giant.
Oh, so that's at the back of my house over at Abriachan. And the Big Pit of the Giant, or Sloch Fahar. So Sloch, you see the word Sloch appears in lots of places, and it just means a pit. So you see it at the top of the... When you're going down the A9, you go over the Sloch. Mm-hmm. And if you look down, you see right next to the road, there is this huge pit, so that's the Sloch. And the Sloch that's at the back of my house over in Abriachan, looking down onto Loch Ness, is really big. So Fahar is giant, so it's the giant's pit. But I don't know where the name came from. The story about how the name got there is lost in time, like so many of them are. But it was a perfect place for illicit whiskey. And if you go down there and you have a rattle around, you can still find bits of broken glass and metal. So a giant-sized pit is obviously the best place for that kind of activity.
Gaelic lecturer Dr. Heather Clown there speaking to us at Monash Moor, you know, Scotland's creative writing centre. A fascinating encounters always round.
It's been a real education this morning, and hopefully we'll continue that. We're talking about Pete earlier on. Mm-hmm. We're being thanked for a repeat now. Thank you for rebroadcasting the magical Adam Watson and Tom Weir programme. I still return to Highland Days and A Fine Day for the Hill, which both provide wonderful escapist reading. Both characters played a role in inspiring my many jaunts into the Cairngorms on foot and ski over the years. I listened to it with my young son. I really enjoy the Scotland Outdoors podcast, by the way. It's a fine escape from an increasingly grim world, and that's Mike B.
Yeah, that recording with Adam, it was 35 years ago. And it was a programme called, was it In the Country?
Yeah.
What was it called?
It was In the Country. I worked on it for a wee while. And it's a fascinating... There's competitive fact suggestions. Yes. Two men who know their story, their subject, inside out... Yeah. Competing with each other to tell the story. It was great. Mystery Bird's taken off a wee bit as well. Christine Urie in Edinburgh. Now, she got it right. I'm not going to tell you what it is. Happy New Year to you all. I think your Mystery Bird is a... The first time we heard these was in rough winter seas off Aberlady Bay in East Lothian. We had to find a way to remember the call so we could find out what it was. And we came up with raw onions. And they've been the raw onion bird ever since to us. Fabulous winter sound. Raw onions!
Ross and Tenno thought it was a cormorant. Craig Wilson from Cardonald, who I don't think is taking this seriously, says, is the mystery bird a bufflehead?
Bufflehead? Eh?
Buffle? What? I have
no idea. Bufflehead? Is it a bullhead?
No, it says Bufflehead here. John and Lois and Rothy Norman say, Happy New Year to the best radio programme. See, that's how you get on. That's yeah. how you get on. It says, Lang may your lums reek. I misread that the first time I read it. Certainly no shortage of firewood. Is your so-called easy bird this morning a gannet? Unlikely, but it's the best we can do this soon after Hogmanay. Love the image of the wood pigeon hanging on by its toenails. Our flock of various small birds has been slowly murdered by a pair of sparrowhawks, the female of which actually perches right beside the bird feeder. Yeah, we've got that problem too. We heard earlier on the programme about the impact Storm Arwen had on forestry in the northeast of Scotland, and we'll hear more about that soon, in fact. But I was also very curious about how extreme weather like that affects birds, other animals and things. So I went to meet Ian Broadbent, who's a recorder with the Northeast Bird Report, at his local patch.
This is Beechwood at the edge of Inchgarth Reservoir, and we've got quite a bit of damage from Storm Arwen. There's a couple of major branches come down from the beech trees, and that's taken out some of the conifers alongside and blocking the path. There's some pretty heavy duty branches across the footpath here.
As a birdman, I wanted to ask you about this, because obviously there's damage all over the northeast of Scotland, you know, and down the east coast. What impact does this have on the wildlife?
Well, in the short term, obviously things will get displaced. Maybe some nesting sites might get damaged, so long-term nests of birds of prey might have come down, for example, or trees where woodpeckers have been nesting might have come down. So in the short term, there might be damage to those sort of sites. But in the long term, it's probably a bit too early to say what the sort of impact's been of Storm Arwen. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is that natural systems are normally quite resilient. You think about an elastic band, you stretch an elastic band and it'll normally come back into place. Natural systems are normally like that. And storms, you know, they're part of that natural cycle of things.
There is, however, evidence to suggest that extreme weather events are becoming more regular. Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence from anywhere around the world to suggest that storms can actually cause wildlife serious difficulty?
Yeah, so it's a bit it's a bit funny to be talking about tropical birds on a day like this in January.
Yeah.
But there's a story of a bird called a Cozumel thrasher. Now, the island.
I like it already.
Yeah. The island of Cozumel is off the sort of east coast of Mexico, and Cozumel thrasher is a sort of brown thrush-like bird. And it was quite common up until the mid-1980s when a hurricane hit. I think it was Hurricane Gilbert in about 1988. And the numbers declined because a lot of its habitat got flattened. There was another hurricane that hit in 1995, and very few of the thrashers were seen after that. And again, a couple more hurricanes in the sort of early 21st century. I don't think there's been one seen now in the wild for over sort of 12 years now. So in island populations where there's not a lot of habitat, if it gets completely flattened, if there's nowhere else for the birds to go, and if there's other pressures. So on Cozumel, there'd been some introduced boa constrictors that had taken the eggs of these birds.
This is almost like a joke.
Yeah, I know. It was like a perfect storm, literally, of hurricane and introduced snakes, and the bird's extinct. You know, the bird is in all likelihood extinct because of the impact of these frequent hurricanes. We saw something similar a couple of years ago in Dominica. There was Hurricane Maria, and that flattened large areas of the rainforest in Dominica, and that's got a really rare bird called the Imperial Amazon Parrot, and they reckon that it was probably less than 100 individuals. When you've got a low population like that on an island population where there's nowhere else for the birds to go, then that's a serious risk to the long-term continuation of the species.
We don't have tropical storms, or thankfully, boa constrictors, you know, not free-range boa constrictors anyway, but anecdotal evidence, I mean, and this is from me, since Storm Arwen, because we're on the flight path between Lochastrath Beg and Lochaskeen for the geese, you know, and I would expect to see probably several thousand geese every day. The number of geese transiting us has gone way, way down, and I'm assuming they've just gone somewhere else.
Yeah, so weather patterns will affect where birds sort of feed and where they move and when they move as well. So, you know, birds will move when the weather conditions are right, and they'll find food where it's abundant. The important thing really is that these might be just short-term transitory changes. The important thing is that we get good data. Observations such as yours can feed into large-scale databases over a long period of time. So we can look at the trends over a number of years and say, well, actually, is there something happening with the pink-footed geese population?
Anecdote is fine, but you need the science.
Well, you need the science to back it up, to analyse the trends, because it might be that they've just gone to the next valley or to the next set of fields, or they've gone somewhere else temporarily. But if we're looking at trends over time, we get a better picture of what's going on, and we can then sort of target conservation measures to intervene if necessary.
And with perfect timing, we've got Big Garden Bird Watch at the end of this month.
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's a fantastic citizen science project that's, as you say, I think it's the 28th to 30th of January. People can get on board with the RSPB via the website to record their observations in the garden. And that's really useful because it's a long-term project. It's a sort of standard methodology that they've got. It's simple. It's easy to do. I think it's an hour of your time. You can just look out the window and count the birds that you see. But that's really useful in building up a population of what species are doing well, what species aren't doing so well. Things like generalist feeders like goldfinches, for example, have increased massively in the northeast Scotland over the last 20 or so years. Blue tits seem to be doing really well. But things like greenfinches and chaffinches, to a certain extent, not so well. So there are changes all the time. And without the data, we can't really understand what's happening. The other really good source of information and data on changes in bird population is the British Trust for Ornithology, the BTO. And you can go onto the bto.org website, and they've got lots of information not only on how you can take part in surveys, but also on changes in bird populations and trends. So things that have gone up, things that have gone down, and maybe some of the reasons why.
Ian Broadbent there from the North East Bird Report, and there are links on our website to them, the RSPB Big Garden Bird Watch and the British Trust for Ornithology as well. Tons of stuff.
Yeah, we were talking about all the brash and the branches that came down. I've noticed a lot of the birds are sheltering under there to get away from the sparrowhawks.
Yeah, no, well, exactly the same here. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are just a few ways of listening again.
There is no excuse, but you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. I do beg your pardon. We love hearing where you listen. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Duncan Grant did. And he says, "Hi guys, in spring 2018, I emailed you from the Alps whilst working for a campaigning company." Camping company putting up tents. I listened to Monica Wilde whilst hopping around my kitchen preparing Christmas dinner for some of my family, sometimes on one crutch, sometimes on two.
And he explains, "I ruptured my Achilles 3 weeks ago while watching a classic car rally come up Brigaboon, in the dark. I jumped off the bank and it was further down than I realised. I hope you had a happy Christmas, and thanks to all the team and the kind folk at Raigmore Hospital as well." That's Duncan in Strathspey. Well, one thing that you can be positive about is the mystery bird. Now, somebody got in touch and said it was a bufflehead. Mm. Neither of us had any clue what a bufflehead, but it's remarkably close. This is what it sounds like.
So a bufflehead's an actual bird?
Bufflehead is a beautiful little bird. I'm almost getting too... But you're absolutely spot on. You could just change the colouring of the bufflehead and you've got the bird. So get in touch, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. No prizes for getting it wrong and no prizes for getting it right.
Yes.
Owen's taking your calls, 0800 085 9200.
Well, if I could just apologise to Craig Wilson from Cardonald, we thought you were taking the mickey. Yeah. I nearly said something else there. Right, OK. Wednesday this week, 5th of January, marked the centenary of the death of the great polar explorer Sir Ernest Shackleton. On that day, historian Dan Snow announced that he would be taking part in a fascinating Antarctic expedition to try and find Shackleton's ship, the Endurance. And I'm delighted to say that Dan joins us now to tell us more. Good morning, Dan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm really good, thank you.
Thank you very much. When do you actually set off on this trip?
The 1st of February, we leave Cape Town in a big survey vessel, and then we hit the ice about a week later, and then we, well, depending, of course, how thick the ice pack is this time of year and how extensive it is, and then we go down and we camp on the ice, and then we drop drones, unmanned underwater vehicles, through the ice and start the survey.
Wow. What happened to the Endurance in 1915?
Well, it's one of the great... it's the greatest story of... Yeah. Heroism, survival, probably in history. It's one that I'm sure we're all obsessed by. And Shackleton took this ship. Interestingly, he didn't take Discovery, which Dundee built, and he didn't take enough. Well, Dundee whalers with him. Really, his ship was lightly built. It was a kind of for tourism. It was built in Norway, but it was cheaper. See, he had money problems. So he took this ship down. It was probably inappropriate, really, to overwinter in the ice. It was crushed in the ice on his way to Antarctica. He never even reached Antarctica, and let alone fulfilled his mission to hike across, drag or dog sled across the continent. And it got crushed in the ice. They moved onto the ice. Endurance sank. They watched it sink. They lived on the ice camp. Then the ice started to break up because the summer came. They got in small boats, just about managed to get to a place called Elephant Island. They were at the very limit of their endurance. Many of them were sort of broken by that stage. And then him and the five fittest men went from Elephant Island, which was uninhabited, they had no real chance of rescue, to South Georgia, 700 miles away across the Southern Ocean, unimaginable hurricane force winds, extraordinary. They got to South Georgia. They hit the wrong side of South Georgia. Two men were broken. And they then... three that were fit, could still walk, basically, hiked over the top of South Georgia, mountains, glaciers, the first ever hike crossing of South Georgia, across the interior of South Georgia, and reached the whaling station on the far side, which is why, and so they just about staggered in. The night they arrived, there was an extraordinary blizzard, thick snow fell. They would certainly have died exposed up on the mountains if they'd been 24 hours later, 12 hours later, really. So it's one of those extraordinary tales.
You've got somebody like... Sorry, beg your pardon.
You announced this expedition on the Discovery in Dundee this week. I mean, Discovery was a significant ship for Shackleton as well.
Well, that's right. I mean, I don't think enough people are aware of that. I mean, Discovery was the first purpose-built Antarctic research vessel in British history. It was beautifully constructed. It was every item of that. It was double hulled. There was massive strengthening around the bow. It was designed to go to high latitudes. The crew wasn't. The crew, in that weird British Edwardian way, were just a bunch of gentlemen amateurs. He seemed like a good chap. Let's take him. So Scott was in charge, and Shackleton was the third mate. So Shackleton's first ever trip to Antarctica was on Discovery, and he did a lot better to take Discovery down for that famous third trip in which he lost Endurance. But anyway, so that's why Dundee's a very important part of this story. Not only, as I said, many of the whalers, much of the knowledge and Antarctic knowledge that existed in Britain was in Dundee, but also Shackleton ran as MP of Dundee and crashed out, getting no votes. So he said, I got all the shares, the other fellas got all the votes.
Somebody like, Robert Falcon Scott, Scott of the Antarctic, he's a romantic, tragic figure. Roald Amundsen, a real professional polar explorer. What's your take on Ernest Shackleton?
Well, it's such a good question. I'm sure you guys are aware of all this, the swirling debates. I mean, Shackleton was an adventurer. He was a chancer. He begged, borrowed, and stole money. It was a bit dodgy. All his expeditions were bankrupt before he went. He was selling off the rights to this newspaper and that newspaper. He was a self-publicist. He was described as a bit of a rogue. But you get him on the ice and you get in a difficult situation, and there was no one better. And I think that's what's important about Shackleton. That's why he's the sort of real hero for us, because he had massive shortcomings. I feel really good about Shackleton because he made loads of mistakes. He never really believed in skis. Can you believe that? He didn't think skis were really worth it in Antarctic in snowy conditions. He only later in his career came around to dogs. He never really bothered learning how to properly get command of a, you know, work out how to train and run dogs teams. And so he was, in some ways, kind of a bit hopeless, but in other ways, he was the single greatest heroic leader for an expedition when it got in trouble of all time. So he might have been the reason the expedition got into trouble, but he'd also be the reason it got out of trouble, because he was astonishing, charismatic leadership. He seemed to know people's minds better than they knew them themselves. He would look at a group of men, he'd know when one person needed a little pick-me-up, he needed a little hot drink, a biscuit. He'd give his last biscuit to a member of the team, and that member of the team would be loyal to him for the rest of his life. Like, he had this extraordinary mix of capabilities, weaknesses, and I think that's what makes him kind of approachable. He's not just some hero that we are forced to kind of admire, like Alexander the Great, or sort of, where we don't know really what the real man was like.
As often happens at my age, there's a quote dancing in the edge of my consciousness, and I can't remember precisely how it goes, but it references Scott and it references Amundsen, but it finishes, "But if you want to come home, go with Shackleton." You know, and he, as you say, he really had the hearts of the people that he lived and worked with. How are people going to be able to follow your journey?
Shall I quickly give you the quotes? It's so good. "For a joint scientific and geographical piece of organisation, give me Scott. For a winter journey, Wilson. For a dash to the pole and nothing else, Amundsen. And if I'm in the devil of a hole and want to get out of it, give me Shackleton every time."
That's the one. That's the one.
He was a member of Scott's last expedition, that chap. Anyway, so yeah, it's very exciting. So I'll be at History Hit, my podcast and video channel and all that kind of stuff. We're going to be broadcasting the whole thing live. Brand new satellites, in the spirit of Shackleton, really. He always embraced new technology. He once took a car to the Antarctic, which travelled about 10 foot before collapsing. He took cameras and the latest cameras and things. So he loved all this. So we're taking all that. We're going to be TikToking and we're going to be Facebooking and we're going to be Instagramming from the Antarctic. History Hit for all of your needs. It's going to be great fun.
Dan, I am sick with envy. I would love to be involved in something like that. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. Dan Snow there, and there is a link to the History Hit website from ours. I wonder if they'll find it.
Hey, yeah, but it's the, you know, it's the phone call that has never reached us, that one saying, "Hi, do you want to go to the Antarctic?" "Yes, I do."
That's
but
the one.
It's never happened.
Never too late. Earlier we heard how foresters and sawmills are pulling together to deal with the enormous, I mean truly enormous volume of fallen timber caused by Storm Arwen in November. Now, I was speaking with Will Anderson, who not only runs Seafield and Strathbay Estates, but is a regional manager for CONFOR, the forestry industry body. We were standing not very far from Portsoy, looking at one of the forests he manages, you know, and it was pretty well devastated in most places. And I said to him, OK, you're going to be repairing this. What next?
What we have is we have a forest plan. We have an outline of what is likely to be felled and restocked over a period of, in detail, 10 years, in outline, 20 years, and in long outline, 40 years. So we know where the forest is going to go. Unfortunately, things like this just kind of put the ball on the slates.
Man proposes, God disposes.
Exactly. Yes, that's it. And so we have to revise. But we were fortunate to a certain extent that we tend to work in five-year phases, and our permissions from Scottish Forestry come in five-year phases. So a lot of our damaged woodlands were in the first 10 years. So we had intentions to fell them in the first 10 years, the next 10 years anyway. What we had was a plan that said, well, we'll do this in 2022, this in 2023, this in 2024. We're going to have to completely change that around about and look to bring some of those, advance some of those fellings and delay some of those fellings to allow us to deal with situations such as this. We have more of a problem where the damage has occurred in what would have been later phases. We've now got to go and look at those and say, right, where can we bring them forward? How is that going to affect us? How is that going to affect us in terms of change of species or replacing things? So we know roughly what we've got to plant back in here. It's a question now of just changing that roundabout and getting that again back into some sort of structure based on prioritising the damaged areas.
As an estate, when you're looking ahead, obviously this is a cash crop. Mm-hmm. You know, yes. You're looking to make money out of this. So what has got more value in the future? Is it something that's actually going to go for timber, or is it trees planted for carbon capture?
Carbon capture, from our point of view, is something that we can't actually get into at the moment because there's no real market for standing carbon. you don't get carbon credits for what you've already got. You get carbon credits for what you're producing. So if we were to plant a new area of woodland on open ground, we could tap into the carbon market there. At this minute in time, we're doing a lot of carbon capture through what we do naturally anyway. I mean, 30% roughly of the estate is timber, is woodland. And so we are actually capturing quite a lot of carbon. We're producing that. We're putting it into construction timber, so it's being locked up long term as well. And then we're growing a second crop further on, so capturing even more carbon after that. The primary reason that we grow trees is timber. And it's one of the income streams for the estate, as you said. So we're looking for a sustainable yield from these woodlands long term for the family and for the children and grandchildren of the current owners.
The forest we're standing in at the moment, as you said, Scotch pine. Trees must be 60, 70 feet high. Fairly mature trees, probably close to being harvested anyway.
Yes.
But you do wonder, just looking at the devastation around about us, what effect it had on the wildlife.
Yes, and it will have an effect on the wildlife. All our licences come from the Scottish Forestry, and we have to comply with the UK Forestry Standard. What we do as an estate is we go on beyond that and we comply with the UK Woodland Assurance Standard, which is a voluntary system where we be externally audited by someone through Soil Association to say that we're doing things sustainably. And that means we take into consideration not only the production of timber, but also the environment and also the social aspects of what we do in the woodlands. The whole idea is to cycle this and structure it in such a way that there's always some place for things to move to if you're taking down areas like this, to leave areas longer term so that we're not just taking trees down at 70 years old, that there's stuff which is going beyond that and is developing a habitat which is much longer than that, in the hundreds of years. It's unfortunate in areas like this, as you mentioned earlier, that the damage happens. So areas that we would have as long-term retentions and have planned to keep long-term, some of them have been snuffed in the recent wind. And we've got to then take that into consideration in other areas. So we would leave certain bits standing. We always want a degree of deadwood in the woodlands because that, again, is habitat in its own right. So in clearing this, we would leave a certain number of those snapped stems to provide habitat in their own right. What we have here is all the Christmases come at once for a particular beetle. And so if we don't clear this up, what we can get is we can get the pine shoot beetle will come in, because a lot of these trees now are either dead or stressed, and it'll breed underneath the bark, and in the manner of insects, it'll breed exponentially. But what happens once it's bred underneath the bark of these, which doesn't actually affect the timber quality, but when it emerges, it'll go and feed in the crowns of the surrounding trees. And it'll then defoliate the crowns of the surrounding trees, which will then stress them even more, and it becomes a cycle. And we can lose value in the timber again from that, and we can have impacts on the health of the trees, and that's by stressing them introduces potential for other diseases coming in. So it's all part of a cycle we have to take into consideration when we're doing the planning, not only from the timber point of view, but also from the environmental point of view and the habitat point of view that we're looking at. How they react is very much what we do is silviculture. We're looking to manage trees, and we need to get them to react in a particular way to produce timber. You have to understand the biology of the trees to do that.
It's so sad to see so much damage done.
It's quite upsetting for me as a forester, because you know, me and my predecessors over 70 years have worked to develop this wood to produce timber for the estate and a habitat, and suddenly we're having to react to this catastrophic damage. And it is disappointing, but always as the situation is, it could be worse. You know, we had 2 years worth of our production damaged. If we'd had a 1953 gale, you know, we could be looking at the whole of this being flat. You know, you've seen the photographs presumably on some of the history sites of what happened in Deeside in 53. I mean, this is nothing really in comparison to that. But we've all been waiting for this to a certain extent, because we know these gales come on a periodic basis. And since 1953, since post-war, we've actually increased the area of woodland, so the damage potentially could be even greater if we get a 53-type storm in future. I say we're fortunate. We're looking at a million and a half cubic metres of timber damaged over the east coast of sort of northern England through Scotland. It could have been an awful lot worse than that if we had the same intensity of gale that we had in 53, or even, say, for example, in 87 that happened in the south of England. But it's going to happen at some point in time, and we are seeing weather events changing. We are seeing the climate change happening. We're seeing the increase in wind damage just, you know, generally, and we have to react to that as an industry and as foresters. And we've got to look at the biology of the trees, the sites, how we manage these, to address that?
Will Anderson of Seafield and Strathspey Estates. Again, whole aspects in there that I just, you know, because I'm not a forester, I'm not involved in the industry, I hadn't really thought of these things.
I studied forestry at university, but I'd forgotten about how easy it is to stress a tree.
Yeah.
And it put it in those human terms, you know, the fact that the trees aren't braced and prepared for a north wind, they're not ready for it. And if you start stressing them, they get disease. Mm. I mean, it's, you know, it's, you call yourself a forester, it's more like counselling to a certain extent.
That's interesting, yeah. The mystery bird has been causing absolute carnage this morning.
Well, that's why we're here.
That's why we breathe. Anonymous call, is it a whooper swarm? I saw one appear 5 years ago that lived with a sheep for a while until it disappeared, and the sheep looked innocent. Mouthful of feathers. This from Jeanette Milton of Campsie. Happy New Year, boys. Boys, bless.
Yeah.
Could today's bird be a great northern diver? It could be, but it's not.
Well, that was the one before Christmas, wasn't it?
Was it not the black-throated diver? Can't remember.
Well, yeah,
same difference. Is this week's mystery bird a common scoter, says Stuart Taylor and Elgin?
Mm-hmm.
It was very close. Baz and Janie from Edinburgh, who obviously weren't paying attention, thought it might be an Arctic skua, which we knocked on the head earlier. Jenny and Paisley thought it might be a time-travelling dodo. Is the mystery bird a Brent Bruce, says Mary Frame from Gifford. And how on earth, Sarah in Inverness asked, do you know there are 7,000 geese flying over daily? What I said, Sarah, was several thousand geese, not 7,000 geese. I have no idea how many thousand geese there are, but there are a lot. Anyway, those are some of the wrong answers, but we do have some correct ones.
Yeah, I've got a couple. Markham, Norkey in Orkney, Ian and Tully Essel, Barbara in Shetland, and Elizabeth Hodson in Angus. So not a huge amount.
Well, I've got a few here. Barbara Garganach, yeah. Pamela in Edinburgh, Fred Gordon, Armadale, Gordon Brown, Moneyfeith, and Christine Ewer in Edinburgh. They all got the correct answer, which was...
Well, that was a tricky one.
It was.
This is the long-tailed duck. As winter slowly crept over the tundra of the Arctic, the birds of the north turned with longing eyes to the south and safety. For this was a harsh land, harsh for a bird that thrived in the icy blasts, but also the object of desire for fox, bear and man. Men that prized the meat, men that sought the eggs from the nest, a nest scraped into the moss and lichen and lined with feathers of down from her own breast. For this was a land of contrast, for those above a hard, hard land, but for those who could submerge beneath the icy crush of summer, this was a land of rich pickings. Cockles, clams, crab and mussels, some so deep that the daylight barely reached the depths. Now way back, way back, in the time before time, there was a duck. A duck like every other, but a bird that kept itself to itself. A distant cousin of the eider. It was black and it was white, but dull. Nothing special. But it was special, for this duck had learned to fly. Not to fly with the migrating geese, not to fly with the dunter, not to fly with the tern or the skua, mere birds of the air, for the duck, named after the aging women of the northern tribes, could fly underwater. The only bird on the globe to master the air and the sea. It beats its wings, driving ever deeper to the ocean depths and the riches below. Past the terns on the surface, past the eider at 30 feet, past the gannets plunging to 70 feet. Downwards, ever downwards, past the red-throated loon foraging at 120 feet. Till, reaching its goal at almost 500 feet, it becomes the deepest diving duck in the world. Now many watched the bird with envy, reaching depths that most could only imagine. A bird that could plunder the seabed and grow fat in the harsh, cold summer of the north. And others watched with other eyes. As the winter loomed, the small, deep-diving duck turned her back on the watery sun of the north and took course for the lands of the Celt.
a land where winters were mild and food was still aplenty. But some resented the annual arrival. And deep, deep, deep in her lair, the beautiful Kiina, the goddess of beauty, of love and the sea, was angry. She was mistress of the oceans, but often took to the air in the form of a fulmar to survey her domain. And as she skimmed over the waves, the other birds of the ocean gathered and called, "Kleena, Kleena, Kleena." And she answered the call. The birds of the Minch gathered in a small bay near Bernary in North Uist. One by one, they made their complaint to the goddess. The old woman, for such was the bird known, takes all our food. She dives to depths beyond her ken and kills the crab, the clam, the bernach, and the struben before they reach the shore. She must be stopped. Kleena listened carefully and took to the air and then plunged deep, deep, deep into a cavern on the ocean floor and waited. All around her, crab and prawn and a lobster scuttled round the rocks. Then suddenly, in a rush of foam and bubbles, the small duck appeared, flying to the ocean bed. As she plucked a bucky from beneath the rock, the goddess pounced, grabbing the bird by the tail to drag it to its doom. But the duck was strong and its wings were powerful, beating ever upwards, the bird slowly, ever so slowly, began to escape the clutches of Kleena. But as she did, her tail feathers stretched and stretched and stretched to almost breaking point, before finally the last tip slipped through the hands of the goddess. And the bird was free, and as she bobbed to the surface, she looked with pride at the new, long, curving tail. Looked in admiration at the shiny black back with slashes of white where the goddess's claws had tried to clutch her, and the bruised cheeks sustained in the subterranean battle of survival. She was truly, truly beautiful, and sang, and sang, and sang. And the long-tailed duck of winter never spoke to another bird of the sea to this day.
The goddess of the sea, if she was...
She sounds like a siren.
No, exactly. No, if she was in space, would she be a vacuum cleaner?
Just vacuum asking. Cleaner. Asking for a friend.
Well, see, the problem I had with that one, you know what I'm saying, the goddess...
Just the one.
The bird, the birds of the sea called the goddess. You know, called Kleena, Kleena. The fire engine arrived.
Indeed. But Malcolm reckons that they're also called Kaloos, long-tailed ducks, up in Orkney. Yeah. And this is nice from Ian and Tully Nessel saying, we were sea-kying amongst a group of these lovely ducks in the Murray Firth recently.
Wow. I got a nice email from Leslie Snowden. She says, I'm listening, or possibly he, I'm listening from Cullercoats in the northeast of England when I wait to see if my park run is still on. I have many memories of living in Scotland and stayed off and on in a cottage in the edge of the Montrose Basin during the 80s. I did a postgraduate course in Strathclyde. I was there in Glasgow during the City of Culture. Best years of my life. The programme brings back wonderful memories. Thank you.
A request has flooded in, saying, Dear Mark and Ewens, such a wonderful programme to begin this year and to herald this year of creative writing in Scotland. The accompanying music with the pieces was inspiring. This is the Money at Moore programme. Was inspiring and sensitive, something we musicians really value. We listen weekly from our home in Asturias in Green, Spain, which is so much in common with my husband John's native Scotland. Even today I smiled at the brownie story. It reminded me of a short piece I wrote a couple of years ago. My tale was about how a brownie can turn into a boggart if not cared for. May I make a request in advance of Burns Night? Would you please repeat your marvellous rendition of the Address to a Haggis, the best ever? Thank you. That's from Dorothy Gillett. I don't know.
Is that yours?
I'm assuming it's yours.
No, we shared it, I think.
Did we? Did we take turn and turn about?
Yeah, that's very unusual.
Very unusual for us to go fair on anything, to be honest. Sadly, that's it for us this week. Don't forget our new Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available today at noon. And look out for our midweek podcast, which marks the centenary of Arcadian poet and author George Mackay Brown. Really remarkable fella, and you know, just with such fun making that up in Orkney. That'll be available on BBC Sounds on Wednesday, also at noon. Until then, from all the team here, again, Happy New Year to one and all, and thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.